co-founder of Opt Out, and he's an investigative journalist, Alex Koch. Alex, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
No, thanks a lot for delving into this and tackling a pretty complicated subject. I appreciate you sharing my work.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by James Brown, Eric Bibb, and The Grateful Dead. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.
This is Daffodil. You're listening to Community Radio KBOO Portland.
I got troubles. I got them too. There isn't anything I wouldn't do for you. We stick together, can see it through. 'Cause you got a friend in me.
On the next episode of Neuroemergent, I talk with Leah Blankenship, founder of the Neurodiversity Alliance at the University of Oregon.
Running a group entirely with neurodivergent people, it comes with its own challenges. So much of what defines academic success for these students is just being a successful adult.
Join us at 11 a.m. Wednesday, August 27th for a conversation about neurodiversity from a Gen Z perspective.
Good morning and welcome to Film at 11 here on your community radio, KBOO Portland. This week, Britta Gordon revisits Working Girls, the Lizzie Borden film, also out on the Criterion label. And in the book corner, we look at a great new book on the films of Preston Sturges. But first, Jeff Gotzel gives us instructions on how to find all of the splendid films we discuss here on the show.
We talk a lot about movies here on Film at 11, because we love them, and most of them are not the ones that are playing currently in theaters. I get asked sometimes about films that people have heard about or maybe seen on my website, and I thought I would take this opportunity to talk about where you can actually see some of these films. The first thing that I would suggest to anyone is to download the app Just Watch onto your phone. This is an app where you can search for any movie title, and it will tell you if and where it is currently available on the streaming services. I use it religiously in my research. It also tells you if the service requires a subscription or a fee, whether or not it includes ads, or if you want to pay for a download and how much. You may find that the film's available on one of the services you already subscribe to. HBO Max has really stepped up their game recently, better than Netflix in available titles. There's also Prime Video and the others. Some of the finest classic international and hard-to-find titles show up on the Criterion Channel. Now that requires a monthly subscription, but they have an impressive archive. Plus, they have rotating monthly themes with films featured only for that month. Your subscription includes email updates on which films will be leaving at the end of the month. Just Watch will also tell you if the film is available on the free library services, Canopy and Hoopla. Now, these are terrific services featuring films often discussed by Britta Gordon here on Film at 11. At the bottom end of the scale are the free services like Crackle, Tubi, and Plex. These are usually Hollywood films whose prime has passed or were never all that hot to begin with. But sometimes you get lucky, especially if you're looking for a particular actor or director. They do often have annoying ads, but you can skip half of them. For decades, the best place for classic Hollywood movies has been TCM, Turner Classic Movies. The channel is available as a free feature on most cable providers. It's an ongoing channel with scheduled times for films, but some people set their DVRs for the movies that they want to watch later, if you still have such a thing. I'm a little unclear as to how to get TCM movies on demand. I don't actually use the service, as I get the titles from other sources, but it's something you can research. Again, all of these services are listed on the Just Watch app, and they do a great job at keeping the titles up to date. But as great as the app is, still my number one source for watching films, old and new, is my local library. If you can actually get up, go pick up and drop off the DVDs like we used to back in the video store days, the library is still your best bet. Why? The extras. It's all about the extras. The commentaries and special features on the DVDs, they can be golden. And if you're lucky enough to get a Criterion edition, that's the best. Not only does Criterion get the best-looking transfers, they dig up amazing archival footage and even create original content, like new interviews with those involved with the film. So if you're living in almost any city in the U.S., you live close enough to a branch library, which, more importantly, connects you to that library system. You can look for that title on their website, order it, and have it delivered to the branch of your choice. I happen to live in Los Angeles, so I have the benefit of two library systems, the county and the city, with branches not too far away. And gone are the days when rentals were only for a few days. You get them for a week, and, provided no one is waiting for that copy, you can renew them at least twice, with no fees for being late on returning. So get that DVD player out of storage, or pick up a new one. You can get a perfectly good one from Amazon for $35, and you'll be glad you did. And finally, for streaming on your laptop or casting onto your TV, if you're able to do that, are the websites. Google the titles, and you'll see that there are three that are worth searching through. The first, of course, is YouTube. If it's an older title, you might find that somebody's uploaded it on YouTube. And hopefully the quality is good enough. And YouTube is available on your big screen service, too, like Roku. And this is not YouTube Movies. That's a separate site. That's where they charge you for the movies. Just regular YouTube. Next is archive.org. This is a kind of public uploading service. Many of the titles have fallen into public domain, but I found many that are not, and in good shape. And finally, there's a site that has been a gold mine for me, ok.ru, which seems to be a kind of public uploading service also. Now, I am not now or ever will be advocating piracy, and the .ru part of this site indicates that this must originate from that unnamed country. And the sources for the actual uploads are pretty obvious when the actual logos show up, like TCM or the DVD distributor. And sometimes you'll hear a BBC announcer over the final credits. But the site's been up for years and nothing's ever been pulled, so it seems to be totally legit. Sometimes there are a few different uploads, so you can pick the best quality. Just be sure that when you Google the title, to put ok.ru afterwards. And then your choices will come up. Hopefully this has been of some help to you all and make it easier to live a better life by seeing more movies. This is Jeff Godsell for Essentials of Cinema, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Jeff. And don't forget to drop into Jeff's website, Essentials of Cinema, for more recommendations. Next is Britta on Working Girls.
Watching the recently re-released film Working Girls, about a day in the life of an upscale Manhattan brothel, set off a series of thoughts that aren't entirely disconnected. About the way in which the current sophisticated state of television production really suits some thematic material, think the employees of a brothel and their clients, perhaps even more than film. about how we take the idea that sex is idealized in a wide variety of films for granted, about the stubbornness of the world's oldest profession, which has fascinated male filmmakers for decades and should be equal fodder for female film directors. The film is directed by Lizzie Borden. I reviewed her first film, the scalding satire Born in Flames, a few months ago. It was released in 1986 and is now out from the Criterion Collection on Blu-ray, DVD, and streaming. Borden is starting to get a belated due with interviews in Vanity Fair and reviews in the New York Times. But unsurprisingly, these two films excepted, she hasn't had an easy time in a system that has limited her control of her own productions. Let's hope the increased attention might change that. Working Girls begins with Molly, played by Louise Smith, waking up next to her female partner. Molly is white, her partner is black. They exchange loving glances over breakfast with their teenage daughter. Molly goes into her dark room to do a bit of work, then gets on her bike, weaving through the neighborhood, stopping at a grocery store for flowers, and navigating her bike into a different apartment, which we begin to understand is a place of work, in which Molly is humorously ribbed by her colleague Gina, played by Marussia Zak, who holds her knees as she tries to insert her diaphragm. Side note, I had to look up whether these things still were used. Apparently, they're making a comeback. Molly is a strawberry blonde. That's important in this film. And it appears she has a degree from Yale. Gina, dark-haired with a quiet voice, lives with a boyfriend and yearns to do something else. Neither has told their partners about their working lives. The third in this trio is Dawn, Amanda Goodwin, who barges in late, throwing her bag on the couch, cursing at the fact that her boyfriend insisted on bringing her to work, resulting in the necessary subterfuge of entering a different building until he finally drove away. Dawn is all expressive emotion. Her hair is teased back in a distinctive 80s horsetail. She's wearing a short leather skirt, and the first thing she does is to beg Molly to write her an essay for one of her classes, on her knees. "It's on the peculiar nature of communist charisma," she wails. "No way," says Molly smoothly. "I'm already renting out my body. I don't want to sell my mind." Dawn is also, from the get-go, the most overtly critical of the so far absent boss, Lucy, but it's clear that employee dissatisfaction is fairly high at this establishment. These conversations, frank, funny, sad, are the lightening highlights of an increasingly monotonous day of one unremarkable yet demanding client after another. In a wonderful discussion over hamburgers regarding whether any of them would like to be the boss, or more bluntly, a pimp, Dawn remarks as she messily gulps down her lunch, "I've always been a whore." One of my reactions to this film was almost visceral, as for a while in the late 90s, I rented a room in an apartment that had very recently, in fact, been a brothel. My enormous built-in bed with lights running around the edges took up the entire room, just down the narrow hall from the closed-in fake marbled bathroom and up the stairs from the laundry area recently opened out from what had been a false escape closet. This world of working girls, like that apartment, has a timeless, closed-off, claustrophobic quality. There's no sense of the outside, of day or night, which makes each successive visit from a client that much more unbearable. How long can this day be? As recent reviews have pointed out, this film is a clear-eyed commentary on the transactional nature of this enterprise, as well as on the relations of labor with management. All of the women try to hide at least some part of their income from their sweet-toned and highly suspicious boss, Lucy, who is conducting a very questionable affair with one of the brothel's clients, herself. They complain of irregular hours. They are clearly made to work overtime. They are asked to offer services, such as what Lucy describes as, quote, light dominance, even though it is against policy. While Lucy, always impeccable in a cream silk suit and teased blonde hair, castigates her employees, telling them the place is a mess. It does get messy. The hamburger leavings aren't completely whisked away before the next client enters. That she only makes them do laundry once in a while, that they don't appreciate that she gives them a safe place. The tenuous nature of her generosity is all too apparent, particularly when a new and clearly nervous employee enters the brothel. Mary, the new hire, gets a tongue lashing for taking a phone call from her frightened child and is set up with a client, although she's clearly not prepared for the experience. Another new hire, who also starts on the spot, is bluntly told that she'll likely attract fewer clients due to her skin color, which in fact is the case if this one day is any indication. The film is unabashedly on the side of the girls, whose mournful, wry, angry complaints against their boss are balanced with a general good-heartedness when it comes to each other. especially in the face of clients who are shown in the many unglamorous ways that sexual proclivities, not dolled up with lighting, mood music, soft lenses, or our general sympathy for their romantic results, are expressed. Clients pose in front of mirrors, get spanked while their abuser raps out a rehearsed text, and force the women to play parts in their scripts involving doctors and virgins. This last is especially poignant given the recent revelations regarding U.S. gymnastic coach Larry Nassar. There's nothing sexy about it, cinematically speaking. But harder to watch, and more instructive, are the scenes in which the men themselves try to stray from this script. "It would be so different, wouldn't it, outside of here?" asks one of them of Molly. This small space allows them their fantasies, but the fantasy is really about taking this fantastical world with them. Of course, it's the one thing those working girls can't promise. Until Molly, after a day in which she's been told both that she's smarter than others and, quote, just a whore, having watched clients pick and choose her coworkers as if they were avocados, witnessed the possible abuse of a coworker who bleeds after a session, and spending all day in the confines of either a tiny living room offering men drinks while they wait, or in one of the lugubrious rooms upstairs, unfolding clean sheet on bed after bed, for client after client, Molly ends up accepting the card of a client who tells her, basically, that he'd give her enough money to live for her services outside the brothel. And after one of several confrontations with her boss, Lucy, in one of them, she asks, "Lucy, have you heard of surplus value?" Only to have Lucy reply, "Molly, don't be so patronizing. I went to a good school, too." After all that, she quits. So much for the get-ahead Yale gives you if you're a struggling photographer in this world. We're not going to know her final decision, but on the morning that she wakes up after that day, as she does in the opening scene of the movie, next to her partner, her eyes open suddenly, as if she realizes that whatever choice she's made is even more terrible. The film is shot TV style, with bright lights and medium close-ups, and makes you wish that Borden might try to do another version, this time a longer TV series in which the characters could be elaborated and the intricacies of the situation teased out, as it were. While you know nothing has essentially changed, the film feels a bit dated, and the characters a bit superficial. I also miss the rebellious, quasi-satirical, all-out headiness of Borden's first film, Born in Flames, in which women unapologetically stage terrorist attacks, castigate each other for not being radical enough, and commandeer society's infrastructure resources for their subversive activities. By contrast, this film is about a world in which subversion is unthinkable because its object, male desire and the ability to acquire what is desired, is at the heart of women's economic daily lives. You can sneer at the guy who's being spanked, but that's about it. As Borden's film points out, none of the working realities of life in a brothel, with one, shall I say, enormous exception, are any different than the realities of any workplace, which is what makes it so amusing, so outrageous, and such a cynical film as well. There are lots of wonderful moments, and Borden gets assistance from some notable helpers. Nan Golden supplies the stills that Molly has shot and is developing in her darkroom. David Van Tiem, a percussionist, composer, and theatrical performer, is responsible for the terrific score, which utilizes bells, claps, drums, and other disconcerting sounds to give a sprightly ominousness to the proceedings. And one of documentary film's most famous cinematographers, Richard Leacock, has a cameo as a client named Joseph, a man Lucy playfully calls her financial advisor, and who tells the assembled girls, plus a client or two, that Lucy's fantasy is, quote, rolling around naked in a room full of money. "I can't help myself," says Lucy cheerfully. "I had a very materialistic upbringing. The two things I love most in life are sex and money. It's just that I didn't know until much later in life that they were connected." The scene goes on with Joseph, who is the light dominance client, telling Molly rapidly in his East Coast City Brahmin accent, I'm in your power. Indeed, the locus of power shifts around in this sinful cloister of an apartment an inch or two, but it's clear that for those working girls who, for whatever reason, have decided to enter this profession without a union, government regulation, or a human resources department, there are just two options, stay or go. In the last few years, Borden's been joined by some other notable digressors from the usual male gaze on the fascinations of prostitution, notably Sean Baker, who shines a mercilessly orange LA light on the world of trans prostitutes in the disconcertingly amusing Tangerine. But if you read the stories in the news media about this trade, you see how very little has changed. Currently, the New York State Legislature has bills under consideration to decriminalize prostitution, which has sex worker advocates and battered women's advocates, among many others, shoring up their barricades. And all presided over by the disgraced Governor Andrew Cuomo. A fitting irony for filmmakers who might see an opportunity. Perhaps someone like Lizzie Borden? She'd make the whole thing into something more than next year's Wikipedia article.
Thanks, Britta. And you're listening to Film at 11 here on Community Radio, KBOO Portland. Please become a member today and take a listen to this membership note.
This is Professor Kitty from the Monday Sampler. Remember that this is listener-supported radio, KBOO in Portland. If this radio station is important to you, please go to kboo.fm/give to become a member. Now, back to Film at 11.
Finally, here is a look at the new film-by-film survey of Preston Sturges' work by Stuart Clowens of The Nation and published by Columbia University Press. About 20 years ago, a book came out called Film as Philosophy, Essays in Cinema After Wittgenstein and Cavell, edited by Rupert Reed and Jerry Goodnow. The Cavell of the title is Stanley, the late philosopher who specialized in cinema. Arguably, his most known work is Pursuits of Happiness, in which he looks at a genre of screwball comedies he called comedies of remarriage. Among the 9 guest writers in this anthology is Stuart Clowens, with an essay called Habitual Remarriage, The Ends of Happiness in the Palm Beach Story, which asks a simple question and comes up with a detailed and nuanced answer. Why didn't Stanley Cavell include Preston Sturges' film, The Palm Beach Story, in his book about the comedies of remarriage? The essay was our first awareness that Stuart Clowens would prove to be an authority on Preston Sturges. Preston Sturges, 1898 to 1959, as an AI writing machine would put it, was an American screenwriter, playwright, and film director during the 40s. He is considered one of the most important figures in the history of American comedy and is known for his witty and fast-paced dialogue, as well as his ability to blend comedy with drama. Some of his notable films include The Great McGinty, The Lady Eve, and Sullivan's Travels. The general outlines of the career of Preston Sturges are well known to most film students. From a childhood surrounded by businessmen and European artists, Sturges eventually wrote a hit Broadway play, ending up in Hollywood writing screenplays, bouncing from studio to studio, until he ended up at Paramount, home of Lubitsch and Wilder. He had also studied the making of his earlier film, The Power and the Glory, a movie that anticipated both Citizen Kane and Pulp Fiction, and realized that he wanted to write his films for sole credit and then direct them. Eventually he did at Paramount, making a run of comedy masterpieces. Now Stuart Clowens has published a whole book that looks at those Paramount films one by one and offers up fresh insights into how they work. After he left Paramount, Sturges fell off the map. He spent a decade in the wilderness, forgotten by film writers and viewers alike, except for people such as Andrew Saris, who interviewed him at the Plaza Hotel in 1957. He died 2 years later. Stuart Clowens is a film critic who has written for The Nation magazine, and his new book, Crooked But Not Common, The Films of Preston Sturges from Columbia University Press, examines these films. In general, the book explores the themes, techniques, and influences that made Sturges' work unique and enduring and provides a deeper understanding of his place in the history of American cinema. Each essay in the book focuses on a particular aspect of one of Sturges' films. This approach allows the reader to gain a deeper understanding of the unique style and techniques that Sturges used. For example, The Great McGinty raises the interesting notion of the use of names in the films, and how in this case, Dan McGinty may not even be the character's real name, but instead made up to make him a more viable political candidate. This is a tale filled with what Clowens calls Sturges' roughhouse glee, but it is also subtle about intimate relationships, such as the arranged marriage meant to make McGinty sellable to women voters. Clovens writes, quote, "But given Muriel Angeles's," she's the one who plays the wife, "habit of keeping her lips breathlessly parted at all times and emitting a gasp at the end of each line, Catherine comes across from the first as being aroused by McGinty. Little wonder that when the couple at last consummate their marriage, after months of supposedly sexless cohabitation, they give the impression of tumbling into a union expressly forbidden by the production code. Their wedding, though lawful, had been fake. The lust looks real." By the way, Clowens correctly identifies the William Demarest character in this film correctly as a ward healer. Few other writers have characterized him correctly. The author is also insightful about Sturgis's second directorial effort. Quote, "Alone among Sturgis's films, Christmas in July is about the public use of words. His other films are as crammed as a fruitcake with boozy plums of political oratory, movie studio puffery, legal double talk, gossip column innuendo, and editorial page pomposities. Only in Christmas in July, though, does the whole action turn on a phrase invented for a corporation's billboards and radio broadcasts. That phrase is, 'If you can't sleep at night, it's not the coffee, it's the bunk.' In as many iterations, most of them garbled, Jimmy's slogan for Maxford House Coffee is the movie. A play of illusions, a tissue of misunderstandings, a sequence of words that might initially sound like they make sense but don't, or that maddeningly make no sense but almost bring an idea into focus." Close quote. With The Lady Eve, Clowens explores why Sturgis pressed a biblical text into the foreground of The Lady Eve and then made its meaning obscure. Here is his take on Barbara Stanwyck watching Henry Fonda in her pocket mirror as numerous women on an ocean liner try to get his attention, calling it a film within the film.
"Every Jane in the room is giving him the thermometer and he feels they're just a waste of time. He's returning to his book. He's deeply immersed in it. He sees no one except... Watch his head turn when that kid goes by.
Won't do you any good, dear. He's a bookworm, but swing him anyway.
Oh, now how about this one? How would you like that hanging on your Christmas tree? Oh, you wouldn't? Well, what is your weakness, brother? Holy smoke, the drop kerchief. That hasn't been used since Lily Langtry. You'll have to pick it up yourself, madam. It's a shame if he doesn't care for the flesh. He'll never see it. Look at that girl over to his left. Look over to your left, bookworm. There's a girl pining for you. A little further. Just a little further. There. Wasn't that worth looking for? See those nice store teeth all beaming at you. Why, she recognizes you. She's up. She's down. She can't make up her mind. She's up again. She recognizes you. She's coming over to speak to you. The suspense is killing me. Why, for heaven's sake, aren't you Fuzzy Oldhammer I went to manual training school with in Louisville? Oh, you're not? Well, you certainly look exactly like him. It's certainly a remarkable resemblance. But if you're not going to ask me to sit down, I suppose you're not going to ask me to sit down. I'm very sorry. I certainly hope I haven't caused you any embarrassment, you so-and-so. I wonder if my tie's on straight. I certainly upset them, don't I? Now, who else is after me? Ah, the lady champion wrestler. Wouldn't she make a houseful? Oh, you don't like her either. Well, what are you going to do about it? Oh, you just can't stand it anymore. You're leaving. These women don't give you a moment's peace, do they? Well, go ahead. Go sulk in your cabin. Go soak your head and see if I care.
Clowens continues, "I would go so far as to say that the film in question is a Preston Sturgis movie, since the combination of her running remarks with more or less silent images replicates the widely touted method of narratage that Sturgis had claimed as the great innovation of The Power and the Glory." Close quote. These are just a few examples of the strange and interesting connections the author makes between Sturgis's work and the real world, as he works his way through each film, one by one. Also, by the way, in Sullivan's Travels, an earlier film by Sullivan, the character, mentioned in passing, has the actual title of Ants in Your Plants of 1939, which again, Mr. Clowens is almost unique in getting correctly. Crooked But Not Common is an excellent book, one of the best film books of the new year, and though he discusses the Palm Beach story, it is a pared-down version of the essay in Film as Philosophy, so interested readers are encouraged to track down that volume as well. Again, thanks for listening to Community Radio KBOO Portland. Film at 11 will be back next Friday, so until then, keep watching your screens.